position number 21291, Wheel 1.
Wing Commander Saunders, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Why?
Where were you born?
Where was I born?
Yes.
Richmond.
Which year was this?
1914, 19th June.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Richmond?
No, I was educated in Genoa in Italy.
How did that come about?
I was born in Richmond, and the house had in Richmond Terrace was bombed in the 1914 war. And my mother had been for her honeymoon in Genoa. My father was sent to the Italian front from Ypres, where the gas attack was. And the units were dispersed, and he was sent to Italy, and he was a scholar. And he had introduced the water polo to Italy. He was captain of the water polo team in Richmond. So my mother, in 1917, took the whole of her children, the five of us, to Italy in Genoa. And my father was a wealthy young man at the time. And so she refused to come back when the war ended. And she had a wonderful voice, and she's over there, you can see her there. She was a lovely person. And we were brought up in Genoa. And that's why I wanted you to read that. Because I mentioned that situation. Those were questions you could have asked me, and you see them there. And as a matter of fact, I point out that when I was 9 years old, in 1923, beginning of 23, with the school, I went to Staglieno Sport Arena when Mussolini had just come into power, and I had to sing the Nabucco, the slave march of Nabucco in front of Mussolini. And he was strutting along. I remember it very clearly. And I remember how I disliked the prima donnas. I had these four sisters who were all prima donnas, and my mother as well. So that being the only male thing in the family, I was brought up to sort of watch out for authoritarians. My father wasn't, he'd come back to England. And so my mother literally brought us up. So I went to school there. And when I was a little older, in my teens, I was put under, I was accused. I had a court martial by the Italians for. I had been heard to say that I wiped my bottom with Mussolini's image, which of course all the newspapers in Genoa had, at the school, where newspapers cut in pieces and put on a hook. And of course Mussolini was in every page. So when I told this judicial review that I had no option but to use Mussolini, so they let me off. But I realized it was going to be a war. It was quite inevitable. And I used to be a member of the GUF, which is a group Universitario Fascista. You know, I had to be. They wouldn't allow me to go to school otherwise. And despite my remonstrations to the authority, to the, our British consul, he wouldn't. He said, no, you do what the, if you want to go to school here. So I was brought up there. So inevitably I wanted to be a fighter pilot. I had seen De Troyer doing his antics over Genoa, over the Lido, and I had seen Balbo come over with his flying over from Genoa to go to America, and I wanted to be a pilot. So I decided that I had to be an experienced one, and exactly as I thought would happen. I came straight to England. I joined the, I got a short service commission in, I joined in 35. I got a short service commission, and mid 36, I was posted and arrived at Marylebone Station with Michael Robinson and Peter Powell. The three of us were on a warrant to go to 111 Squadron Northolt. And so we were, the squadron used by Fighter Command, which was just next door to Northolt, as you know, used for all the fighter attacks. And we had AFD and AFDU and a fellow called Vincent and Tony Vass. They used to run this outfit. And the 23 Squadron was also in Northolt. And they'd used to act as bombers, and we were the fighters. And so all the fighter attacks and all that was all organized by FDE and AFDU. And, you know, I used to remonstrate, you know, very much that, you know, you should have loose formation, not the tight formation we had at the time. And that proved exactly as I expected. As a matter of fact, the German fighters who were experienced when the war started had all learned this from the Spanish. All the German top men who survived, the rest of it, were all in Spain, Garland and all the rest of them. So I was on that level when the war started. We had the first Hurricanes in 1937, so I was the third man to fly the Hurricane. Gillen did, was RCO, and Michael Robinson flew the second one, and then I flew the next one, which was L-1547.
What did you think to the Hurricane at first?
Oh, they were magnificent. But they had all sorts of problems, you know. At that time, we even had retractable tail wheels to begin with, and they still they collapsed very quickly, so they steadied them. But I actually was the first man to discover that that you had to pump the undercarriage solid. And I landed at Tangmere, and it mentioned it in that book. I landed at Tangmere on the beginning of February 38 in a Hurricane. And at the end of my run, it's just about to turn, the starboard undercar collapsed. And we had wooden propeller, two-blade propellers. And the propeller didn't touch the ground. So there was literally the whole of one squadron in 43 was there. Unfortunately, Freddie Rosier died a few years ago, but he remembers throwing his hat up in the air, and they all did, Peter Townsend, Prosser Hanks, and Caesar Hull. The whole lot of them were there. And but I stayed in the cockpit. Some airmen came along, and the wing was lifted, and the undercar came down, and I bumped it solid, and there was no damage to the aircraft at all, and I went back to Northolt. Now, at that time, they didn't know that you had to pump the undercarriage solid, and that's why they put a little notice, you know, pump your undercarriage solid when the green light comes on. Now, that just gives you an idea of the beginning of the Hurricane. We had a lot of problems with the flame traps, a lot of trouble with glycol leaks, and you know, you have great big sheets of white smoke just come out of the aircraft, and of course we didn't realize how inflammable it could have been. It could have gone off like a bomb, but it didn't matter. We had no problem, really. We used to kill the odd pilot, you know, in the squadron. So this question of people dying or being posted was on the same level. You know, you didn't see them again, or that was asked how you were, your mind was adjusted. But we had to have two hurricanes at Northolt to fly them 24 hours a day for 7 days a week. And I always volunteered to fly them. And we had to do them to find out what the problems were with the aircraft. And so I amassed a lot of hours. I remember I kept a hurricane up for 5 1/4 hours once on extremely weak mixture, you know. And I used to love that, going at dawn or before dawn to go down to Cornwall, you know, and hover around amongst the clouds and see the dawn coming. It was beautiful. And we had Gillan as a CO. He was a prima donna, but he was a nice man. He was eventually killed as wing leader at North Weald. And from him, this man Broadhurst took over. He was a horror. We all hated him. And he posted Michael Robinson, who was my best friend, to an MU at St Athens. And I was furious. And he was a very good pilot, but he had told everybody that nobody was quite like him. And of course, I, with my experience of fighting prima donnas, I really decided I'd show him off. And the war had started in September 39, and so he had shot a line that he had taken a gauntlet off with the guns removed and all the heavyweight removed, and he'd done at the air display at Hendon a roll off the top of a loop, and nobody else could do it. Well, I would show that anybody could do it. So I just did that. And on a Sunday morning, the war started at Northolt. I took off and I did a roll off the top, you know, and picking up. But there was a conference and all the VIPs were at Northolt. I didn't realize it. And I was bunged under arrest by Broadhurst, and I was marched the next morning to 11 Group, to Gossage, who my mother knew, and he asked me what would I like to do. I said, I'd like to go to France, sir. He said, right, out you go. That was my punishment. Then he kept Harry Broadhurst in for half an hour, and he came out absolutely puce, so he must have upset the AOC. I was posted shortly afterwards to 615 Squadron, which were gladiators. 615 gladiators, and they were going to France. So, and it was an auxiliary squadron, so that was a double punishment, because the auxiliaries, we looked down the nose at them at the time, and so to be posted there as flight commander of B flight, but they were completely inexperienced squadron. They never should have gone to France. Never should they have been sent out there. There's a fellow called, what was his name? He became a lord, De Vere Harvey. He was CO, but he never flew the squadron. I used to lead the squadron. And that's a story that our honorary CO was Winston Churchill. And so he came to Croydon to see us off with 607 Squadron, which was the other auxiliary squadron going to France. And there was all the VIPs were standing in front of my aircraft, and Clementine, Churchill's wife, asked, could she sit in my aeroplane? And of course, being an idiot, I said, yeah, of course, you know. So I was delighted, you see, there was a great Lord of the Admiralty wife sitting in my aircraft. And I didn't realize that the guns had been cocked, of course, because we expected, you know, there could have been confrontation. We were escorting our two ensigns with all our troops to Merville, you see, in France. And so Winston Churchill was standing, well, it was literally the, you never, when the guns were cocked, if you even wagged the wings or made a false, it would set the guns off. And I had, this is what I hadn't realized, and because if you went to armor practice camp, and you always pointed the nose towards the wilderness, because occasionally the guns used to go off, and this pneumatic system was faulty, and you had to cock the guns on the ground. So our guns were cocked. So I shouldn't have allowed her to sit in my aircraft, and she did, of course. And Churchill was in front of the aircraft, looking at the gun, at the Browning gun, which was under the wing, each side of the wing. It had two flying through the prop, and one under each wing, and there were two witnesses: Brian Young, who became an air marshal, and Dick Paxton. And this was mentioned, that's why I thought you'd like to read it, that book said stories. I gave it to him, and you may have seen it when it came out. I came to the museum for the Spitfire thing, if you remember, and I kept away from it, obviously Stephen Bungay had told them this story of Churchill, because it's mentioned in the book, you see.
We should say Stephen Bungay is the author of the book you're referring to.
Yes, he had told them about it, you see, obviously, to launch his book, and I had no idea. And but that is why it turned up, you know, that I actually knocked her hand off when she came in. I realised the stupidity of me letting her sit in the aircraft, you know. And
so she fired the guns.
She could have done. It could have gone off. It would have killed him instantly. Actually, he was standing right at the back, and there were two witnesses to that, and I had overlooked it until Brian Young said, "Sandy, do you remember when you stopped Churchill's wife shooting him in the back?" I said, "Well, oh yes, I remember that. Yes, yes." So, and Dick Paxton. So I got them to verify it at the time, you know, and after the war when they came to see me. And
where did this incident happen?
When did it happen?
Where did it happen?
I shouldn't show it to you, but I was given by an airman. He came from France, and he brought the logbook of B Flight 615 Squadron, and it's recorded there, the time, the number of the aircraft, the date. I think it's the 11th of November, I think it is 19. I can show it to you in the book there.
But you were in the battle for France, were you?
Well, obviously, I was there. You see, what happened, that instead of giving the squadron to me, because I was a regular, De Verhaeghe was sent to headquarters, promoted to wing commander, and instead of giving the squadron to me, they gave it to Joe Kyle, who was a flight lieutenant the other side of the aerodrome, was 607. So of course, in my flight, I had all ex-air, you know, naughty boys like Bill Fowler and all the rest of them in my flight, all Hurricane pilots, but we only got Hurricanes. Literally, the week before the Blitz. I was on leave in London because Joe Carl wanted me out of the way, and he was instructing the others. It was my turn to go on leave anyhow. And I arrived back literally on the 10th. There were beautiful Hurricanes, and that was my introduction to 615 Hurricanes there. And of course, immediately we were on raids, and you know, we escorted, that's where the CO 6607 was killed, Smith. And then we did, we escorted some battles over the forest, and a lot of them got shot down. I escorted them over Maastricht as well, and I got it with Joe Carl of Blenheim. And there's a book, somebody showed it to me, where Joe Joe Carl said he escorted a Blenheim, one Blenheim, and he was on his own, which is not true. I had two others with me, but I, instead of flying as George Carl being an idiot, he was formating with the Blenheim. Well, you don't do that if you're escorting something. You stay at a reasonable distance and wait for somebody to come along and try and stop him from having a go at it. And as a matter of fact, that very thing happened over just close to Maastricht. And two 109s, I saw them turning round, and they were turning round to come down because they'd spotted this thing, because, you know, the anti-aircraft was firing. And it was very low down, you know. And I actually shot one of them down, one of the 109s down. And then we came back. Now, then we went up to Moselle. I had flown with Joe, and I've got it in record there. I had flown to Evere, and he had flown to Moselle to find a place forward in Belgium for the squadron to move to. And so we went to Moselle and operated from there. And as a matter of fact, when we arrived, our airmen hadn't arrived, and we literally had to start our own aeroplanes. You know, we used to have a handle in the Hurricane, and we used to go on the thing, put the throttle right back, no chocks or anything, pump the thing, get the thing started, and get back into the aircraft and take off and do the trip. I mean, it was just, that happened once, of course, and then the airmen turned up and it was all right. I shot down, I think, in 88, and at Dornier, and eventually, I was very low down, the other side of Valenciennes, on the German border, and I think this gunner must have hit me. I was very low down, trying to, you know, and something hit me, either the ground flag or rest of it. But the next thing I knew, the whole of the engine was completely, the front was completely covered in oil. The engine stopped, and I went straight ahead and crashed. And I must have hit my head very hard, because it was zooming, you know. I could, you know, these children fireworks they have, these sparklers. I was just like that all the time, actually. And but I managed to. Some farmers or peasants came along, and they were very nice, and they helped me out, and they helped me to. I managed to get the parachute. They took me to Valenciennes, and there they said that it could be a train could be moved going down to Béthune. Well, Béthune wasn't far from Abbeville, from Vitry and Artois, where we were stationed. So I got into this train, which was like a Chinese picture. Hundreds of people hanging out all over the place, but they made sure I get in it. I got in it, and the train went about a few miles, and then he was bombed, so we had to stop. Not everybody had to get out and run for it, and I managed to get into Béthune. And at Béthune, I knew Béthune, you know, it's on the Arras Road, so I decided to go up the Arras Road, and as I turned out, I saw a carrier, a German thing. It definitely had markings. I think it was a tank carrier or something, or a grain carrier or something like that. And anyhow, then the next vehicle I came across was the front end of a Queen Mary. So I got onto it. It's the front end, you know. They'd obviously dumped the part of it, but there was the front end of it. And I told them to drive up and go that way. And of course, Vitry was abandoned, you know. Arras was abandoned. There were barricades, but there was nobody defending the place. So we went on. I said, we go to Abbeville. So I knew Abbeville. And arrived at Abbeville. And there were three long-nosed Blenheims on the perimeter of the aerodrome. So I decided, it's fine, I would fly one of them back to England. I'd never flown a twin in my life before. And when you're young, you know, you felt a little bit sort of concussed, I should imagine. And so I said, I'm going to fly one of those away, fly one back to England. So, and then an airman showed me the bobs and bits, and I took off about 2 o'clock in the morning from Abbeville. No flare pass, no, I had no idea where the tips and knobs on the Blenheim were. I had no idea at all how they, it was an air-cooled aircraft, this long-nosed Blenheim, you see. And I asked for two volunteers to come with me. And about 2 o'clock, you can, once it is dark, but you can still see a certain horizon, you know. So I managed to show me the knobs and this and this, but I managed to get it airborne, but I couldn't get above 700 feet, and I couldn't fly higher, couldn't fly more than 110 miles an hour just going that way. You see, I had the undercart locked down. I didn't know it had the locks on it. I had gills open. I had fine pitch. I didn't know if I had any petrol. And so I came over that way, all the way back to England. And as it was just getting lighter, the first thing I recognised was Virginia Waters. You know, it looks like Mercedes. And I had seen a Blenheim land at Northolt before the war. I'd seen one land, and it came over Western Avenue, put its nose straight down, and went up that way. I'm going to do that in the right direction. So I just did that. I was nearly on the ground, it was 700 feet, literally. And I just did that. I got down, all in one piece, and I stopped the aircraft near the tennis court at Northolt, which I'd been there for 3 years since my station. And there wasn't a soul in the aerodrome. Not just nobody. And it was about 3 o'clock or there, about in the morning. It was just getting light. And there wasn't a soul. And I ran to the duty pilot's place with my aerodrome and rang and a little WAF answered the phone. And I said, will you put me straight through to the station commander? You know, I was a bit demented at that time, but you can probably realize it. And the station commander spoke of Vincent Keller, who was in charge of AFD. By that time, he became station commander, you see, and took over from Aldebar, so I believe. So I called, but anyhow, he was there, and I told him what I thought of him, because the girl has said she's not to be woken until 8 o'clock. I said, do you realize the Germans are going to be the next lot coming in? And all this fury, you can imagine the words I used. And he said, you're insubordinate, and how dare I talk to the station commander to him, and I'm under arrest. So I was under arrest when I left Northolt, and I was under arrest when I came back. A few hours later, I was taken to 11 Group, and they put me in a car, and send me straight down to Manston, back on Gladiators to do the Dunkirk thing.
Which squadron was that?
What?
Which squadron was that?
Oh, I don't know, 264, I think it was 264. I've got a little record somewhere. And from then, on the 4th of June, that's when Dunkirk had finished, I was flying Hurricanes back at Kenley in 615 Squadron.
Did you operate over Dunkirk?
What?
Did you operate over
Dunkirk? Oh, yes, we went, look.
What do you remember about operating over Dunkirk?
Yes, we did some sorties and headed straight down to Manston, shooting down or anything like that. personality. But, let's see. Then on the 4th, I was back on Hurricanes, but Kedley. Playing Hurricanes, Kedley, and Winston. Back on Gallup. We literally, as you can see from here, we escorted bombers.